These kids were not ready for Joe Pesci.
And apparently, yeah. She did nick his little finger. And yes. He has a little scar, a Joe Pesci tooth mark.
Yes. They're lucky that that's all he wanted to do. They haven't seen Casino.
There was no buildup. Why am I crying right now?
There's various stages of old that were all less old than his real old.
Than his real old. And we're back. Hey, guys.
Hey, guys.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Crowded Theater Podcast, the only podcast where all movies are seen in theaters, not on video, not on streaming, not cheating. The only podcast where we see our films enmeshed in the social network that is the movie theater, the spiritual network, if you will, like all of the Na'vi around that tree in Avatar. Remember that? That's kind of what
we all were connected.
Exactly like that. So anyway, hey guys, how are you doing? I'm Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
How many film screens do you think could fit in that Na'vi tree? It's pretty big.
It's a big thing. Oh, speaking of which, I'm interacting with this plant.
And I am Cliff, who is not a Na'vi, but wishes he was some days.
There you go. Just because we're really into James Cameron, that into him, that we want to be tall and blue. Hey, guys, how are you doing?
Doing well.
This is our kind of final week before Christmas. We're going to be heading out, so this is our last little podcast to get out before the holidays. Do you guys feel sufficiently amped? Is all of your Christmas shopping done?
No. No. But a lot more in the Christmas spirit than I thought we would be. We didn't really get into the full spook season spirit, so I'm glad that we really sort of embracing the Christmas spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and it has been a fun Christmas season, and this film that we saw was one, I think, of the highlights of our Christmas season thus far, and definitely got us in the Christmas spirit. We saw the Christmas classic, Home Alone, from 1990, written by John Hughes, directed by Chris Columbus, starring Macaulay Culkin, Daniel Stern, Joe Pesci, Catherine O'Hara, others as well. But we saw it in a fantastic context. No, we did not watch it on DVD. We did not watch it on Disney Plus. We saw it at the Paramount Theater downtown.
Thousands of other people.
Yes, 1,000 other people. Yeah, yeah. They had the Paramount is doing a series. The Paramount is a big old theater in Austin, holds about like 1,200 people or so, and it was packed. I mean, they've been doing a bunch of movies for the Christmas season so far. I don't think we've seen anything in the Christmas program so far. Did we see anything there yet? No.
I don't think so, no.
Yeah, yeah, but we saw something in there and some things at their Halloween program, like Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
And we went there, and I think they was part of an event was going on or something, because it was packed.
A lot of wristbands. Anything where there's wristbands, you know, at some events that you're not part of.
Exactly.
But so we bought tickets.
We bought regular tickets with the plebs and sat in the balcony. And it was just, again, really packed. 1,000 people, lots of kids.
Lots of kids.
They had a snow machine outside spraying snow.
It was bubbles.
It was bubble snow. And then they had a person dressed as Santa Claus and a whole like Christmas vibe going on. So that was pretty rad. By the time we took our seats, they had projected the Home Alone logo onto the big red curtain that they have at the Paramount, because again, it's a fancy old theater, etc. So they'd projected the Home Alone logo and some falling snow. So it was a really cool vibe, and a lot of kids buzzing around, and a tremendous amount of kids who were definitely too young to have seen the film when it came out, because they did not exist. these lots of young
children. Their parents may also have been just too young.
This is true. Some of the parents of these children may have been too young to enjoy Home Alone. Who is the perfect age to enjoy Home Alone in 1990? Cliff and I. That's right.
Born, I think we were 8 and 5,
respectively.
8 and 6 or something?
Yeah, I was born in 85. So it came out in 1990.
Okay, 1990. So. Oh, yeah, 5 and 7. Yeah, that is the perfect target demographic for Home Alone.
I being a 5-year-old or so when it came out, 5 or 6, I remember the nuclear bomb going off that was Home Alone, which instantly became, you know, my favorite movie. I mean, what could be possibly be better than a crazy kid running amok in his own house without his parents, living, eating ice cream, watching watching trash, which is exactly what I wanted to be doing all day long, and then ultimately demonstrating how tough and awesome and badass he was by taking a BB gun, the one thing that my parents would not buy me, and a bunch of shit in his garage.
Isn't
and kicking,
that also what yeah. the kid in The Christmas Tale
Oh, yeah,
also
Christmas
wanted?
Story. Yeah. That's a good point. That's mm-hmm. a good point. Both centered around BB guns, except this is a far more kind of like post-Reaganite use of the BB gun, where it's not just a whimsical object of a kind of a morality play about learning your parents are right in A Christmas Story, but instead is literally the Rambo weapon used by this kid to take down the home invaders, played by Daniel Stern and Joe Pesci. I don't know. It's difficult. This is another one of those movies like talking about Terminator or something like that, where it's difficult for me to separate my experience with the film from the film itself, because I just remember it felt like Home Alone was the whole world back then. And I like so many things when you're a kid, like, you know, the music of the hip-hop duo Crisscross, you realize perhaps in retrospect the whole world was not as on fire for Crisscross and their backwards pants as you were at that time. However, it was interesting in the intro, because there was an intro for this screening, the guy who does the Paramount programs came out and did a little intro and mentioned the rather astounding fact that when Home Alone came out, it was number one at the box office for 11 weeks in a row. Which, considering no film is at the box office and won number one for 2 weeks in a row, really anymore, except for, you know, a couple singular things in the last couple years, 11 weeks in a row. So it really does seem like the world was as on fire for Home Alone as it seemed.
I think the host mentioned that he was watching a Christmas movie in February in the theaters.
Yes. He was saying that, like, the film was still in the top 10 by, like, June of the next year.
February.
Yeah, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
June of the next year, and all of a sudden it was in June, and he was watching a... June, and he was watching a Christmas movie, and so I guess it's the kind of thing where, Cliff, what else do you remember from our time? You were slightly older, had a slightly less soft brain at the time. What do you recall of our experience?
Well, I just recall the whole, you know, big marketing campaign for it, seeing all the trailers, seeing all the gags.
So you have a pre-Home Alone memory of the anticipation of the film. Talk to me more about that, because I remember seeing it, I remember the enthusiasm for it, I remember watching it on VHS, but I don't have as clear a memory.
My memory just of the pre-expectation and then as it played out was, you know, the trailers and all that stuff and behind the scenes were featured on Good Morning America or whatever, where Daniel Stern is interviewed in full makeup with a iron imprint on his face and stuff like that.
So you remember that when it played?
What was it going with that? Anyway, just remember, the part that was all real interesting in the trailers for me, obviously, is all the, you know, Looney Tunes gags, basically, where it's Kevin playing Bugs Bunny taking on some silly burglars and just wanting to see that. And I remember my experience watching the movie the first time was mostly, I was like, when are they going to get to the beating up the burglars thing? This is so fucking boring. When is he going to get to the thing with it? And then, when it happened, it was the greatest thing ever.
Yes. No, I remember, to speak to that, something that, and part of the reason we're always seeing films in the theater is because, as we've discussed many times, the theater tells the truth. The theater, you know, if you have a bunch of people packed in shoulder to shoulder, their subconscious reacts to the movie. They de-individuate into this big collective spirit of collective effervescence and blah, blah, blah. And we experience something very unique at this Paramount screening. Again, we're seeing the film with 1,000 people. There's a snow machine outside. Tons of kids in the audience. But to be honest, for the first half of the film, everyone's laughing, everyone's enjoying it. But I'm less acutely aware of the fact that the audience has so many children in it. Because we're all laughing. The register of the laughter, its timbral quality, is a mixture of adults and children. You know, high and low. And then Joe Pesci gets shot in the balls with the BB gun, which I even remember as a kid. It's like the entire movie is a drawing of a bowstring, and which then is released when Kevin McAllister finally shoots him in the balls with the BB gun, thus initiating the whole cascade of home invasion, defense gags, etc. But I can tell you, in the year 2024, divorced by decades from enthusiasm around Macaulay Culkin or the marketing campaign around the movie or any of that bullshit that you could use if you wanted to deny the undeniability of Home Alone, the moment that happened and that bowstring was released, for the next, well, until the end of the movie, really, for the next 30 minutes in the Paramount Theater, you could hear such a high-pitched, audible shriek of the laughter of the children. You guys were there. That just immediately from that moment on went above that of the adults, and the laughter from one gag would not resolve before the next gag had happened and the next, and so it would build
little laughter. So yeah,
to the point where even in the off moments, in the tension moments that were supposed to be like waiting for Daniel Stern to, you know, pull the thing so the iron drops on his head, there's just off rhythm squeals of laughter because you can just feel other kids like remembering the gag that just happened, re-laughing at it or laughing in anticipation of just the
they
just
know
sheer anticipation of what's about to happen. You know, these all of a sudden, on a dime, we become acutely aware of like, oh my God, there's so many fucking kids in here. And again, just as it did in 1990 and probably at every other year between, Home Alone playing to a crowded theater full of children is gangbusters. So I strongly recommend the experience if you can go and do that, because it was pretty rad movie going experience, I must say. So yeah, what else do you guys remember about the screening? The kids? I'm not lying, am I, about the kids?
No, that's exactly the moment where I was like, oh, there's a bunch of kids around us. And then they just kept laughing the whole rest of the way. I was like, oh yeah, I'm glad a lot of people brought their kids out. This must be a lot of people's first, and what cool first experience to watch such a cool movie. Like, to be a kid to literally see it in a theater, even in the balcony or whatnot. Like, the balcony honestly added a lot to the experience. I mentioned when we sat down, because we had a kind of like an off-center angled view of the screen, so be it. I was like, it almost feels like we're in a drive-in. Like, feels like we just got a kind of a lucky spot. We're about to watch a great movie. And then, just at that one exact moment when Joe Pesci got his ball shot, you just hear this rupture of like, oh my gosh!
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. Cool. Yeah. No. So I mean, let's talk about it. Home Alone, Cliff. Home Alone. What is? I don't know. What is it? What is the plot of this movie for the uninitiated? For those who have not seen Home Alone before, give us a little summary of what Home Alone is about.
Oh yeah, to give you just the basic trailer summary. Kevin McAllister is left home alone by his family. Home alone in a big old house for Christmas.
Yes. And he is a child. This is a relevant child. Fact. Oh, yes.
Kevin McAllister is an 8-year-old child.
Yes.
Old enough to develop reason.
Yes, exactly.
Still a bit insane.
Yeah, the film begins in the chaos of the McAllister household, a very well-off Chicago house full of two large families full of relatives who are all swirling and spinning about in a chaos, which Cliff and I can talk about, coming from a big Catholic family ourselves. Most of our holidays looked very similar. I know Taylor does not quite have as many cousins as we do, but most of our holidays had like 45 people.
At least 4 or 5 sets of aunts, uncles, and their respective children mingling in some household or another.
Indeed. And in that chaos, the youngest and most mischievous of the kids, Kevin McAllister, who's a real thorn in everyone's side with all of his questions and his inability to pack his own suitcase and his immaturity, is
his little bit of like driving, like his my jaw drops every time he's like, why don't you put the phone down and make me leave the room or whatever. I was like, what the
it's
heck?
Like, what the hell? Catherine O'Hara should slap that little
kid. Just give
kid
him a little, like,
yeah,
backhand.
I know,
just
yeah,
a
that
little.
That is, it is funny just to hear, because those got big stabs of kid response as well, and I just, that was that kind of Bart Simpson-y energy of just showing like a kid talking back to his parents and it being kind of naughty is just an interesting, it's I don't think that quite exists in movies today, just in the sense
all kids are now little adults that are just wanting to be smart or go have their own ambitions at the age of 8.
This is a good point. Yeah, no, I think it's the kind of thing where that felt fresh and new, like it was like slightly transgressive and spicy to have a kid like sassy, even a sassy way. I remember Bart Simpson kind of just being rude to his parents.
Oh yeah, this is a peak Bart Simpson era.
Exactly. This is a very this
is 2 years into the Simpsons existence.
Yes,
is it not?
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, I don't know. So, what is it? Home Alone. The family then leaves for 2 weeks to go to Paris for Christmas, and they leave little Kevin McAllister at home alone. So he awakes the next morning, and here, let me turn this down.
After having been into a fight or getting just unjustly punished, makes a big wish that he that everybody would just be gone, or some wording like that.
Exactly. And that, there we get into the sort of, I don't know, slightly kind of Capra-esque quality to this whole thing, which again, we talked about last week on our previous Christmas episode, which was a film written by Chris Columbus, Gremlins, and this shares a lot of DNA with that film directed by Chris Columbus just a few years later. And there's this interesting thread, because on the level of just manifest reality, on the level of plot, it is the story of an overwhelmed family that then just leaves their kid at home, and then everyone sort of via circumstance learns this lesson about the Catherine O'Hara spends the rest of the film desperately trying to fight back to get to her son, who has wished away the family that doesn't appreciate him and persecutes him because he is so small, ends up, you know, wishing his Christmas wish to have them back. But there is this interesting thread that is introduced at that time, or at that moment, in the early part of the film, where as Kevin goes to bed that night, he wishes that his family would just go away. And then that wish is occasioned by a wind that is given a lot of screen time. You know, a wind that blows one tree and blows another and blows another. And then eventually it is this wind that knocks down the power line, thus causing the power outage, thus causing all of the hectic chaos the next morning when the family sleeps in. They are late for their flight. And in that chaos, Kevin is left at home alone. So this wind, which is given so much screen time, introduces an interesting thread throughout the rest of the movie wherein Kevin is there seems to be an uncanny presence, not unlike in a Frank Capra movie, wherein the presence of a like in It's a Wonderful Life, we have the literal presence of angels around Christmas. So this film, it threads that idea in, but it does it very subtly and cinematically. In the same way,
if an angel were wind,
yes, exactly. And that same idea that even Spielberg uses in even Raiders of the Lost Ark. Spielberg, who obviously somewhat mentored Chris Columbus. Every time, you know, they pull out the amulet in the Raiders of the Lost Ark or make reference to the Ark, God's presence is seen in this wind that shakes all the jangly shit they have in the Middle East, or makes a single candle flicker in front of Karen Allen's face. So he makes this wish, this uncanny wind blows in and ends up knocking down the power lines. Later on, when we're seeing the sort of dynamic difference between, we're seeing the moment where Kevin's parents, Catherine O'Hara and the other guy from Chud,
forgot he was in that.
I think he's in Chud. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So is Daniel Stern, I believe.
Yeah.
So,
oh, he certainly is.
Yeah. And so what we end up seeing is a moment later on where Kevin is at maximum transgression in the absence of his parents. He is, as he says it, he is eating junk food and watching trash, and he puts on a film with a very provocative title, Angels with Filthy Souls, yeah. which Taylor went, when she saw the title.
I know, it's like, even porn.
I know. The funny thing is, obviously, Angels with Filthy Souls is a reference to Angels with Dirty Faces, the James Cagney movie, which also just is a... Well, has a more perverse connotation.
Honestly,
in it.
Yeah.
Yes. Good movie.
Why are these angels so dirty?
Exactly. Why are their faces dirty specifically? There's an answer to that, but it reads different in 2024. But no. So what is it? Kevin puts on the film. film Angels with Filthy Souls, he sees a guy blown away, again, as we learned in the other Joe Pesci films like Lethal Weapon 3. Gun violence was a very big deal in the 1990s. So the worst thing he could do is put on a video seeing someone blown away with a Tommy gun while eating ice cream. Go ahead.
Oh, is this also the same year for Joe Pesci as Goodfellas?
As Goodfellas, yes. Mm. So same year.
Yep.
I was going to get to that. I actually made a note, but what a good year for Joe Pesci. And again, I just remember growing up when Joe Pesci was just the biggest movie star in the world. And between Home Alone, the Lethal Weapon movies, My Cousin Vinny, there was just a period where, I mean, he was my favorite person to see on screen. And then he just sort of vanished after Gone Fishing. We never really saw him again.
But then came back for The Irishman.
The Irishman.
Where he was various stages of old that were all less old than his real old.
Than his real old. Like, you see him, and they're like, ah, at last, they've stripped away the digital makeup, and you can see Joe Pesci fully old, and then they strip it away more for, like, the special features. Like, Jesus, he's so fucking old! He's, like, scary old! It's like, oh, man, I'm so glad they put computer stuff over his face. He's so old.
But here, he was less old.
Indeed. He was less old in this film. There's a very... very robust Joe Pesci at the peak of his powers, throwing as much energy into this film, certainly, as he did into Goodfellas, but fewer F-bombs and less blood and stabbing. Mm-hmm. There's some stabbing in this film.
The roles are related. There's many parallels, but different genres.
Indeed. But good year for Joe Pesci.
It's the kids' movie version of his character in Goodfellas, basically. Yes.
But to finally wrap up this one thread, though. So he watches Angels with Filthy Souls. He covers his eyes, gasps, you know, because he is frightened, he is at home, etc. And then we cut to his parents in the plane, and the father is reading Nobody's Angel or something like that, another angel related thing. And is it that moment that Catherine O'Hara wakes up with the uncanny awareness, the psychic awareness that she has left something behind? And that is the scene that ends with her, of course, yelling, Kevin, and realizing that she has left.
Does she not receive a psychic signal from Kevin shortly before that, right before we cut to that scene? I can't remember.
I think that's the idea, is Kevin's scared, and she wakes up abruptly from a dream. Mm-hmm. She was sleeping on his shoulder, etc. And so we see that same
idea. Stay on that scene for just a quick moment. I do want to shout out to all guys just being like, yes, darling, it was the front porch or whatever. He was like, that's what it was, and I'm sorry. Like,
Door.
To stop this now on this airplane.
No, that's good. It's like, calm down, honey. I'm sure you're mistaken. But what I like is that they were able to introduce this kind of Capra-esque Clarence the Angel figure that blows in on wind, his presence is sort of occasioned and signaled by the presence of the book, and all of these little uncanny psychic connections, and yet we never actually see a embodied angel on screen. And this, of course, because it's a Christmas movie, there's infinite opportunities for angel imagery. So as they go, he even goes into the church at the end of the film to pray for the return of his family and everything. Lots of angel imagery. And then immediately as he walks into the church, we immediately are greeted with the full choral impact of John Williams' arrangement of O Holy Night with fall on your knees and heed the angels' voices, etc., etc., etc. And it just kind of gives the whole thing a very Christmas as something of tremendous spiritual significance and sort of transformative power to heal families and all this other kind of stuff. Something that all of the kind of nonstop ironic Christmas films that have been created in the last few years, like whatever the Seth Rogen one was, I don't know why that leaps to mind all of a sudden, or Office
Hot
Christmas
Frosty.
Party, or Hot Frosty, perhaps. I don't know. I don't want to prejudge Hot Frosty. I haven't seen Hot Frosty, and I don't think we can do it for the podcast, unfortunately, because it is a Netflix film. Therefore, it will never play in a crowded theater. But I would bet that there are probably more heartstrings being plucked, I'm guessing, I don't know, in Hot Frosty than we're giving it credit for. Or maybe that's just because that one guy from Schitt's Creek is in it.
So
I don't
good.
Know. There you go. So there's another Catherine O'Hara connection right there. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but... but yeah, no, I like that, all that. Sorry, we kind of went off on a whole tangent to kind of go through that weird. But I like the idea that all of this stuff, all of this what could be a very, very, very broad and slapsticky movie that's just about people being hit in the nuts and knocked down stairs and all this other stuff, does, again, because it was the early 90s, 1990, and it was a fucking movie, it has all of this sort of spiritual meaning and heart and, you know, and warmth, you know, pumped through it. Even I think Chris Columbus, we were looking at it, said that the character of Marley, played by that bearded old guy who's was in a lot of stuff, that character of the old man who is rumored to kill people in the neighborhood and hide their bodies in salt, and then we realize that he's just estranged from his family, and it is Kevin who in the church at the end, after hearing O Holy Night, from the mouth of a babe, he gives this old man advice, and then finally at the end of the movie, when Kevin's family has returned to him, he looks out the window and the old man has reunited with his family, and it is all very heartwarming, and you have that intense, we'll get to more in a minute, John Williams music swelling up that caused Taylor to start sobbing at the end of the movie.
I was like, why am I crying right now?
Why am I crying at the end of Home Alone? Yes, no, you got, and you then you used my shirt as a handkerchief, as you always do.
As my right.
Yes, as is your right to do. No, but all of that was beautiful. What I like about it is that, again, when we think Home Alone, we think antics, we think nut shots, we think people being hit in the face with a can of paint, and yet the experience is one of that is very emotional, that is very that has that kind of, again, you know, reverence for Christmas, or that kind of awe-inspiring and transformational idea around what Christmas can do, blah, 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 that one felt watching It's a Wonderful Life, or one felt watching a kind of classic Christmas movie. And that, almost more so, I think, than all of the slapstick and all of the nonsense, seems to account for it just, I don't know, having penetrated the zeitgeist and carried over. Because there's a lot of, I watched a lot of slapsticky shit when I was a kid. I think
Looney Tunes is the best example.
Looney Tunes is a fantastic example. I love Looney Tunes, but I'm thinking more like Bushwhacked, starring Daniel Stern, or something like that, which is just, again, I don't, not to dismiss Bushwhacked, but another movie starring Daniel Stern, which is probably a good movie. I don't remember, but I'm just saying that why Home Alone? And I think part of the reason is at a moment in the year, probably when people are looking to feel that kind of transcendent Miracle on 34th Street effervescence of Christmas, it is the film where Joe Pesci gets shot in the balls with a BB gun and hit in the face with a paint can that brings them there. Mm-hmm. And now if you think about the distance between that transcendent ecstatic emotion and the cathartic laughter of seeing Joe Pesci get smacked in the face with a whatever, or Daniel Stern screaming because he has a tarantula on his face, you really can fully grasp the dynamic power of
Home Alone.
It's
funny just thinking about it.
It is funny just thinking about it. I know, it's one of those movies that, man, it is, we're kind of just trying to reckon with its power, having just come out of that crowded screening, because again, it is undeniable. Those kids were set on fire by this movie.
Oh, it was like a whole, like, normal theater's amount of kids. Like, just because you're in a theater of 1,000 people, so it's called, like, even just 10% is 100 kids.
Oh, yeah, no, it's quite a lot of kids. Yeah, no, a couple of
the ratio was higher than that.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so it just, in that, and like you were, exactly like you were saying, it was like a camber of everybody's laughter, because it was just a great movie, and the moment his balls got hit and he turned around and was like, just a whole, you could just really enjoy the genuine enjoyment of a kid's laughter of a silly movie.
No, absolutely. So, as Kevin McAllister is left alone, home alone in his house, what I think you were just pointing to a moment ago, Cliff, was the idea that the film is kind of a slow burn for the first little while, and it takes a while to really get in gear as Kevin McAllister slowly learns to kind of live his little independent life and conquer his fears of the furnace in the basement, and sort of learn to be a little man, and goes on his little arc of maturation, going to the store, and in a way, one could look at the whole film as sort of a kid, sort of a a kind of a hyperbolic dream about what it feels like as a kid to have to do something like go to the grocery store or pack your own suitcase or whatever as the first thing. In the same way that the heater we see both in the film and its real life state, the furnace and the thing. It's just a dead furnace. And then we see it through the prism of Kevin McAllister's subjective fear, his child's POV. And again, so to talk about the mentorship of Spielberg, so many scenes like the store scene are shot like E.T. Here we are now two movies removed from Gremlins they're shot like E.T. from the child's POV, looking up at all of these different things. Go ahead, what are you saying?
I was going to say, this is also a noteworthy difference between this and Home Alone 2, which we also watched a whole bunch as kids. But Home Alone 2, basically, he starts off as a little kid superhero right from the beginning.
Yeah.
But no, what I did appreciate this time was the very long arc Kevin goes through from being a fearful kid to l'incompetent, as his sister or cousin said. Too incompetent to pack a bag or do anything on his own, and then slowly becoming a little man, and then becoming infused with the power of the angels.
Indeed, indeed.
In order to...
a warrior of God, like the Blues Brothers. Mm-hmm. Yes. What is it?
To rain paint cans from the heavens.
Exactly. This is his house. Exactly. This is his house. You must defend it. What is it? So, yeah, in a weird way, it's this kind of interesting thing, because a choice I never really appreciated until now, and we're kind of jumping all over the place, but is the fact that Kevin, this is important, at the end of the film, does not call, and the film goes to great lengths to do this, and it almost doesn't make sense, but you're so caught up in the what's going on that you just don't necessarily notice it, is that Kevin calls the cops finally on Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern at the end of all of the chaos, but he calls them not to his own house, but to the house across the street, a house which is awash in water, rushing because the wet bandits had clogged it. It was the Murphy's house across the street.
They go to like Arkansas at the beginning of the movie.
Exactly. And so he calls them to that house, races to that house, goes into that house, and it is within that house that Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern finally grab him and are going to bite off his fingers or whatever in the last little bit, which is a fun, that's definitely, I think, got a little gasp out of all the kids in the audience as well, because I don't think they have that shit in kids movies anymore. These kids were not ready for Joe Pesci, okay? They were not ready for him. They're lucky that that's all he wanted to do. They haven't seen Casino. As he rushes into that house, the effect is eventually old man, what's his dick, comes in and bonks him on the head, and he immediately, the cops come and arrest them, etc. But the effect of that is that by the time Catherine O'Hara and the guy from Chud come back, by the time the family returns, they are wholly unaware that anything has transpired. This film could easily have a denouement with them arriving back and seeing, you know, cop cars and seeing Kevin, and they're reunited and with like police tape, you know, in the background, you know, and oh my God, what's happened? Is Kevin okay? And oh, he's come out all right. And they find out, oh, this is a very heroic young man. Do you know what he did? Kevin, you did all this on your own? And literalize it all in that way, you know. In fact, I think a lot of films today would do this, but they're unaware. And so when there is, in one way you could look at it as just playing towards the final line. Hey, Kevin, what did you do while we were around? Oh, while we were gone. Well, I just hung around. Ha ha ha, it's very funny, they're unaware. But on a deeper level, you can also view it as, was it all in Kevin's head the whole time? You know, were the burglar, did he in fact see two guys in I'm wearing actually a OK heating and plumbing shirt, plumbing and heating shirt, the van. Did he in fact see some sketchy looking guys in a van that scared him? And just like the furnace, just like the checkout lady, etc., seeing them through the distorted lens of childhood, him surviving these nights in this house by himself, even to the extent that even if no burglars came in, he had his BB gun and put Christmas ornaments under the windows just in case someone came in, which feels like a very kid thing to do, and defended his house to make sure he was safe from all the monsters outside. is as the parents come back in, Kevin has gone through this whole experience, etc. But the parents see no evidence of the struggle that Kevin has gone through at all.
None of the adult world knows really what happened besides him and the two burglars.
Exactly.
Who themselves seem to come out from another universe into this universe.
Exactly. And who, again, the whole thing is sort of this weird, it's like the whole furnace issue at the beginning kind of teaches you in a weird way that kind of POV of the movie. And obviously, you know, it's not about whether or not these, you know, obviously within the movie world, all of these things are quite literal and all of this happens. But instead, it's a way of thinking about the movie as being, it's more relevant to the interior experience of the child maturing by like buying milk and going to the grocery store than it was about the parents coming home and finding out their kid got two burglars defeated, which would literalize it in a way that would take all the magic out of it. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, the only two possible interpretations are one, it was a dream in Kevin's head, or two, he was imbued with supernatural powers by angels in a church, which allowed him to do impossible things in order that no 8-year-old kid could possibly to defend a house.
This is
true. So those are the only two possible interpretations.
This is true. I mean, in the esoteric sense, there is that idea of genius not being something that is located in the material mind, but genius referring to higher spirits or angels that act through people. And so there is this very, and I hadn't thought of it that way, but that is a cool way of thinking about it, that like the heroes of old, like Alexander the Great making sacrifices to the gods of war, that he goes to the church, he confronts his fears in talking to the old man. In fact, you know, in a weird way, Kevin is both the old man and the young man. He sees the reflection of the man who is himself, who is then isolated from his family, etc. And then after all of this angel talk, the wind blows, he is imbued with a mighty fiery sword of this strange and uncanny genius that is born of him
suddenly put together all these booby traps and whatnot. I believe it's just 1 hour a time, more or less,
and
which is impossible without the genius of angels.
Exactly.
Like,
and thus acting as the righteous sword of God and defeating the wet bandits, using his fire implements like his hot doorknob and his blowtorch.
Which is a quick side note. What was that device?
It came from a grill, it looked like it is a heating coil that is in a. But I don't know what that particular use of that thing is. But no, I wondered that myself. But it's clearly a big heating coil that is just put over the doorknob.
Yeah.
But I don't know. But it was taken out of a grill in the thing.
I missed where it came from.
Exactly.
So
I myself have no idea.
Which then imprinted a M, just like the.
Yes.
McAllister M in the palm of Joe Pesci, just like the emblem of the Ark amulet in the palm I forget the actor's name in Raiders of the
Evil
Lost
Nazi
Ark,
guy.
The evil Nazi guy with the glasses. Who's
this
all
is a good point. So this film has two things in common with Raiders of the Lost Ark. Well, three if you count John Williams, but also has so it has the wind angel and has palm burning into the hands of
palm symbolism.
Yes, and their hands are burnt.
Palm
and
branding,
which is interesting because I didn't think, because in Raiders of the Lost Ark, that's a much more loaded idea. The idea that the Nazi touches the emblem and it burns his hand because he is evil and cools it off in snow. Interesting. Yes, good point. Good point. Whereas this, it's a more of a gag. But now, if I view it through the lens of its meaning in Raiders of the Lost Ark, then all of a sudden I'm like, yes, of course. When the evil person finally touches this house, aglow with Kevin's radiant and angelic light, it literally burns his hand, you know. So there you go. What were the peak gags and reactions?
I think the iron on his face, because he had like that scar on his face for a while throughout.
Yes.
And then I cringe
when he sits up and you see the imprint on his face. That was
a big
laugh. Mm-hmm.
I cringe in any nail through the foot gag.
Oh,
yes. So he also wobbled for quite a while afterwards. Uh-huh. He got a lot of good giggles from kids.
And what else happens? There's the, again, I feel like the paint cans is almost the crescendo of all of the different things, because they fall and they get hit and it's, I don't know, it's good. And I remember my parents needing to explain to us, because the big danger in the 90s, of course, was that kids would repeat dangerous stuff they saw on TV. People forget Home Alone was borderline dangerous back in the day because it had kids talking back to their parents, and it had to be explained to kids that you do not try and defend your house with booby traps if you see a burglar. You call the police. But it was also explained to us that don't put a paint can on a rope and swing it over stairs to try and hit your sister in the face because it will liquefy her brain.
That you might need a PSA about that, because that's easy enough that a kid could pull it off.
It looks like so much fun in the movie. It's interesting to think about just those antics needed. We were saw it at an age where they had to be unpacked. Like, this is not actually paint can physics. Like, this is dangerous stuff, guys. So we were warned, and you know, thankfully we were mature enough to handle Home Alone as children.
We understood how it worked. We saw Looney Tunes.
We got it. So again, I don't know. There's so many different dimensions to talk about. I don't want to keep going on and stuff. But a couple things. I mean, we kind of touched on it before, but this is peak Joe Pesci. So the film has Macaulay Culkin coming off of Uncle Buck, who had worked with John Hughes before. The script was kind of sort of written for him, directed by Chris Columbus, who ended up getting very lucky with John Williams coming in and doing the score, which I really think, I mean, how it incorporates all of the Christmas themes and yet is incredibly mischievous and yet is very, very, very Chuck Jonesy once we get into all of the all the slapstick comedy and everything, is one of John Williams' very best scores. We were just kind of had it on a little bit while we were preparing for the podcast in the background. And remarkably not just, I know, it's just incredibly dynamic. It reminds you how dynamic the movie is, because a good portion of the score is very dramatic and serious and epic, like when Kevin races back to the house from the church, and all of these heartfelt moments. It's a very heartfelt score, and then it turns on a dime into this incredibly fun and mischievous Chuck Jonesy type stuff. And again, it just, to whatever extent the movie would have worked before, same cast, same everything else, I think the John Williams score is part of what drove all of the children in the audience to a fever pitch, because I think he kind of understands how well the music can play in that Chuck Jonesy way, because speaking of relationships to Raiders of the Lost Ark in that same way that all of that great Chuck Jonesy comedy works in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where the music is playfully interacting with Karen Allen pulling out a knife and another knife. A guy pulling out a sword and then Indy pulling out a gun. It has that same pinpoint kind of playfulness with those scenes. I don't know. It's just... Mm-hmm. We could go on and on about John Williams. Just kind of wanted to kind of give him his due, because it really is a fantastic score. And then what else? Oh, Catherine O'Hara as the mom. I mean, that's essentially such a big part of the movie opposite Kevin is Catherine O'Hara's whole arc. We have now talked about on... she was just... she's having her moment again with Schitt's Creek and with Beetlejuice, which we just saw in theaters.
And likely soon to be Beetlejuice.
Probably. They will probably make a third one.
Because that one made money.
They made a whole bunch of money. So hopefully we'll see another one of those. But no, the Catherine O'Hara stuff's great just because it reunites her with John Candy. They are both very Chicago-y, very Second City people. This is a very Chicago-y movie because it was, you know, comes from John Hughes. So it's basic, in a sense, it is kind of mini Ferris Bueller. You know, it's like Ferris Bueller, Chicago, John Hughes, both characters who have been recently speculated on the internet to be sociopaths in that hip way that people like to psychologize movie characters. Sense that the character shares that spirit of Ferris Bueller's rebellious defiance of convention and his desire
to superhuman ability to pull shit off that no person that age could.
Yes, exactly.
Which is the magic part.
No, that is the very magic part of it. And I don't know. So were there any? Let's see. John Candy, Catherine O'Hara, very Chicago-y people. I was trying to think if there's anyone else who pops in. I'm sure there's probably folks that who were... oh, yes, yes, I remember specifically. Yes, there was one that popped in. One of the members of the polka band, John Candy's polka band. This was also a... Did we... Oh, yeah, we did. We recorded this episode, but I don't think we released it, The Fugitive. We did it as a warm-up episode with no video. If you remember when... which is also a Chicago movie. When Harrison Ford is staying when that Russian woman and her drug dealer son, who gets arrested but sells out Harrison Ford, the drug dealer son is one of the members of the polka band who is sleeping. So there's another...
At least he turned his life around.
Exactly, exactly. He turned his life around. He's no longer selling out Harrison Ford and selling drugs from
but
the house of
his Russian
mother. But
apparently he's also still a bad parent, because everyone in that polka band was not a good parent.
They had, they had not given up their families for rock stardom, but for polka stardom.
Polka.
Traveling 40 weeks a year for just for to polka it up. So for the love of polka. so what else? What is the thing? Cliff.
Yeah.
We grew up with big families.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, as well. So the beginning of this film has 75 million characters in it. And very normal for a holiday. We were not flying to Paris when we were kids, nor did we live in a house that was as big or regal as the McAllister's house for any of our holidays. But we had many, many, many cousins.
Your childhood home is pretty big.
Yes, but we had most of our Christmases were in Port Arthur at our grandparents' house, which was a little smaller. And given the number, my mother has seven siblings in her side of the family.
True.
So she has six brothers and sisters. And so
most of whom also have kids.
Have, yes, spouses and kids. And so we would have we all had kids around the same time. And so we would have big holidays full of lots and lots and lots of people, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember it, yes, being a very energetic and transformative time of the year, which... true to the underlying themes of many Christmas films, it is difficult to, seems to somewhat difficult to recapture in adulthood. And yet this film, this Home Alone film, reminded me very much of that spirit of being in the big house and the transformative do and all of that. And I'm wondering, what is missing from current Christmas films that they don't have that? What is... I don't think that, in one sense, the bigness of the family and all of the family running around and hating each other and coming together and love each other at the end is a plot conceit. It's how the kid gets left at home. Why else would anyone leave a kid at home unless there were 7,500 kids that you could conceivably lose track of one?
And the shuttle bus is also a fun touch.
Yes.
The cars are still here.
Indeed, yes. I do like that idea, so that Kevin is young enough to believe that he did in fact vaporize his parents because their cars are still there. But the big family is a microcosm for society. No, the big family in this coming together again at the end, I don't know. I think it gives the film power in a way that not a lot of things have these days, because this is where I'm leading with this, and I want you to speak to this, Cliff, because they don't have an appreciation for the idea that there is something... And this idea is perhaps thought of a bit as a bit conservative or a bit passé, but there is something transmutational about the reunification of a family that is schismed into its profane reality, or schismed by being estranged, you know, like the old man is, or schismed by fighting over the course of the year, that then during this one time of year there is something transformational about that unity. And am I wrong, Cliff, that we just don't see that very much in cinema anymore?
I don't.
Unless
think
maybe
we do.
It's on holiday.
I mean,
like
it would be. I would assume it's on kids' movies and kids' channels and stuff, to the extent
is
that
it
does exist.
Taylor?
But certainly, it seems absent from mainstream theatrical production, so far as I'm aware.
Yeah, there's a lot of irony in Christmas movies, and there's a lot of antics, and there's a lot of this. But Taylor, am I wrong? What about your generation?
You know, I feel like that type of setup, it definitely is in a lot of Christmas movies. Like, one of my favorite underrated Christmas movies is a movie called Unaccompanied Minor, which is just a bunch of unaccompanied minors at an airport. And because they're all seeing divorced family or doing this or doing that or for whatever reason going alone, and they all kind of find this found family, I think there's that becomes the segue or the kind of the replacement holder for a lot of that. So yeah, maybe yes and maybe no.
I'm trying to think, because I still, you know, there are still Christmas movies that come out. I mean, we were even last night, we were at we went to the Circuit of the Americas here in Austin because they were doing a Christmas light show where you drive your car through a bunch of Christmas lights, and they had then they had a big Christmas fair where there were rides, and we went with our two sisters and our two nieces and she rode a bunch of rides, and it was really a lot of fun. But at two different places within this whole thing, they had movie screens set up where they were playing movies, and there were clips from various movies. One of them was the Gizmo Gremlins clip from Gizmo from Gremlins getting the Santa hat pulled on his head at the beginning. Another clip was Kevin McAllister racing down the stairs in his sled, and yet there was an absence of any culturally significant newer. Maybe Elf was the most recent one, but for my money, I cannot recall if does Elf really even have? I guess James Caan is in it. Does Elf? Do you know Elf better than I do? Does Elf have familial unity at the end of that film?
Oh yeah. No, like the whole thing about Elf is that he's an orphan looking for his father.
Yeah,
and
he goes to that business guy looking
for his dad, the business guy, and he has to find the heart of Christmas. Yeah.
By the way, you know the business guy, James Caan, that's, you know, from The Godfather. That's Sonny from The Godfather, who gets shot a bunch. Yeah,
I'm a little bit of a Grinch if I myself a bit. I love Will Ferrell. I'm not the biggest Elf fan.
Okay, an Elf fan.
I like Will Ferrell, and so therefore you would assume, but no, I'm not the biggest Elf fan. But I'll give it a good...
What are some of your favorite Christmas movies, Taylor?
Some of my favorite Christmas movies, we just saw Four Christmases the other night. That's one of my favorite Christmas movies. I really like Rise of the Guardians, the Jack Frost movie. I think that's a great one. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I wouldn't say it's one of my favorite, but I've definitely seen Polar Express often. It was definitely an event in Austin to go to the train and, you know, kind of reenact certain scenes. That's very nostalgic. Mm-hmm. But the movie may not be the best movie.
I really like Polar Express. I mean, the Bob Zemeckis thing and all that.
For sure, for sure.
You know, even though their faces look weird and creepy the whole time, I can't get over it. You know, I don't watch it a lot, but I like the movie. What was it? You just mentioned a couple. There was another one you mentioned just before.
Four Christmases, Rise of the Guardians.
Oh, Four Christmases. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'd never seen Four Christmases before. We just watched that the other day. But I did want to. Four Christmases is an interesting example to contrast against a Home Alone. I like the movie, and yet at the same time, you know, there's a lack of robustness to Four Christmases in the sense that it feels like a film that was very convenient for all the schedules of the various participants involved. They cast lots of actors. They cast Robert Duvall, also from The Godfather, Sissy Spacek, also to play Vince Vaughn's parents, Sissy Spacek, who we have now seen for this podcast in both Three Women and Carrie. And who are the other parents? Oh, Mary Steenburgen. And who was the father? Who was the other person?
The father of the...
Reese Witherspoon's dad in the movie. Who plays Reese Witherspoon's dad?
Who is dating another girl now.
Oh, John Voight. That's right. John Voight.
There we go.
So you have a bunch of big names.
Recently appearing in Megalopolis.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Who we also talked about on here. So we have a lot of faves. And yet, it's just interesting that I was left feeling somewhat hollow at the end of the film because you never see the family actually come back together on screen. They are reunited textually. That is to say that Vince Vaughn makes peace with Robert Duvall, but we never really bring them all back together on screen. Instead, we're left with Reese Witherspoon and Vince Vaughn being shot in some two-wall set where they've given birth to a baby and there's some little humorous denouement. And just thinking about the robustness
specifically don't let the family in to see the baby.
Exactly, yes. Oh, how convenient. Oh, yes, just outside of this door, we have Robert Duvall, Sissy Spacek, John Voight, and Mary Steenburgen.
But we don't get the shot from Parenthood panning across the whole family in the waiting room.
Exactly. Man. Parenthood being another movie that certainly we related to a lot, having a big family that was around a lot. Another, you know, film that has Mary Steenburgen in it. And there is just something about the power of that, introducing that chaotic and at odds family at the beginning, and then seeing them all pour in and all reunified around Kevin and all actually physically there, and there being more speaking parts in the movie than there necessarily had to be, mm-hmm. which is another very sad fact about Hollywood these days, is that now, due to weird ideas about royalties and things, like they films are squozed down to the smallest number of speaking parts possible. So the most robust family you'll get is four fucking people, and you'll get lots of scene. Anyway, the point is, there's a robustness to this and to that family and to those sequences at the beginning where you have reams of characters who only occupy maybe a few moments of screen time, but who are well cast and well considered, and many dynamic looking child actors who can tell all of them apart and look as incongruous as an actual large family does when they actually all get together.
Fuller gets very little screen time, and yet when he sips that Pepsi and grins devilishly, exactly. We know exactly what's going on.
And he's the other Culkin, and I'm sure if I watched what was that show, Succession or something, I would know which Culkin it was, but I don't. But it's that other one who isn't Macaulay Culkin, who people like, and he was a child actor too back then. And that's the kid who plays Fuller. And now mm-hmm. you know that. Mm-hmm. And he was going to pee in the bed. But I think that's just one of those things that, another thing that just feels nostalgic but also kind of bittersweet, is the fact that a film like this would have couldn't exist, could not, you would not see a film with so robust a family filling out a house today. It would be quite a bit thinner, quite a bit less well executed, quite a bit less robust, and therefore the emotional impact of seeing them all come together at the end and that kind of reunification would not really feel quite the same. They are us. They are the crowded theater. They are the unwashed masses in the theater, who we all enter and we're munching on popcorn, doing all these things, and then by the end of it, we are all unified by the angel of cinema.
Just sprinkle in the note of, it's also fun, just as a side note, like, they don't walk in all coming to rush and pick up mm-hmm. Kevin and put him on the shoulders like a sports team and like enchant Kevin.
Everyone's very chill.
Everyone just walks in as if they just got off the plane and are coming home.
It's the one thing that almost pierces it into the point of like borderline uncanniness of like, is it all Kevin's dream? Is that like when the mom comes back, she's like Kevin and hugs him, and then like the parents come back and like, what if this whole thing was just one long dark night that Kevin had to spend at home alone, and one trip to the grocery store and one, you know, whatever, and they actually came back 8 hours later, but to him it was days and days of battling demons and all of this other shit. That's one thing I do appreciate, in just on almost that heightened mythological level, that when he enters the Murphy house at the end, that like there's water rushing everywhere, to speak of Robert Zemeckis movies, where at the end when people are in the kind of getting into that inverted dream world, there's always water around. And then Joe Pesci, like we talked about it before, but then they hang him up on a hook, basically, even though it's a coat hook. Mm-hmm. It's very much reminiscent of the meat hook in Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I literally
Massacre.
Thought that too. I was like, are they about to fucking torture this little guy?
Yes, exactly. That's what they're going to do. They put him up on the meat hook from Texas Chainsaw, and then Joe Pesci says, not unlike a monster, says, mm-hmm. I am going to bite off all of your fingers one mm-hmm. by one.
And apparently, in the special features, he did nick his little finger. Yes. And he has a little scar, a Joe Pesci tooth mark.
Yes, and that, again, I think just drives that idea home that he is a nightmare. He is a fantasy projection. He is all of this darkness that then somehow vaporizes and the police come and whisk them away, not from Kevin's house, but from a literal mirror reflection of Kevin's house across the street, where there's water running downstairs and everything's topsy-turvy. And then the parents come home, hug Kevin. Everything seems remarkably chill for, you know, everything that's gone into it up to that point. And then he looks out the window and he sees himself as an old man reuniting with his own family. And the transformational and transmutational power of Christmas and John Williams' score was too much for Taylor, and she started she started ugly crying.
That's not true.
She was ugly crying.
That's not true.
No, you can't do anything ugly because you're too pretty. No, but it was funny. I think I do like that you were like immediately when the credits went down. You're like, why am I crying at Home Alone?
Well, it was funny too because I am not a non-emotional person. I cry in theaters too.
No.
But it was funny too because as I was happening, I was like, "Why?" I'm not because usually you know you're like, "Oh, this scene or this moment that they're holding each other, whatever." I'm like, "There was no build up. Why am I crying right now?"
There was a build up.
The whole movie was a build up.
Exactly. Why was she crying, Cliff? Why was she crying at the end of the movie? Why when we see Kevin looking out the window through snow at the old man reunited with his family, why? Now, a cynical person would say that, you know, like the people who call Forrest Gump nostalgia bait, a cynical person who does not understand the transmutational power of Christmas would say that was just, it's emotional manipulation. You got a score, you got an old man hugging his kids. That's just, it is what it is. Why is Taylor crying really, though, Cliff?
Well, that's where the entire meaning of the movie is summed up there, is where all the families are unified.
Exactly.
And where the score comes to full fruition, and Kevin sees himself unified with his family on one side of the window and the old version of himself on the other side of the window, mm-hmm. all united together, all the meanings, all the themes, everything has been building mm-hmm. towards that moment.
Yeah, and in a weird way,
we're overwhelmed with emotion.
And in a weird way, the old man, he somewhat resembles... check this transition out, the hermit card in the tarot,
mm-hmm.
because Kevin himself recedes into a kind of hermit state, mm. living alone and not with his family, and so he sees through the window a reflection of himself in this hermit state as the old man, and he sees the potential, the sort of timeless nature of his life where he is both old and young at the same time. And he has to go through then this I'm just trying to transition to the tarot draw part of the thing. I was hoping something more clever would come out, but nothing ended up happening. But anyway,
don't be a hermit is the broad theme of the movie.
Don't be a hermit.
Be with family, at least on Christmas.
Exactly, at least on Christmas. Okay, well, I think as we're hitting about the hour mark now, we could go on and on about Home Alone, and I'm sure there's lots of relevant factual information about the film that other podcasts, I'm sure, could tell you about. But we're not here for that. We are here to give you the straight juice, if you will, because human beings can only speculate as to the meanings of these things, but not unlike Kevin McAllister in Home Alone. We will consult the spirits directly for their
juiciness,
predictive juiciness. powers. So yes, that's right. We're consulting the spirits directly. I did a tarot draw before the podcast to consult the spirits as to what lessons we and our audiences might take from Home Alone into this next week. So Taylor, take the top card and reveal it to the audience.
Maybe.
What is it? It's the Magician card again. Hey, we just had the Magician card. Fantastic. I think we had the Magician card maybe on the Megalopolis episode, actually. I feel like talking about that the Magician was Francis Ford Coppola. Interesting.
John Boyd is the unifying element. What does
yes,
that mean?
Yes. That's interesting, interesting, interesting. So we talked about the Magician card is about is the kind of first trump after the Fool card, and is the sort of masculine expression of this magical dynamic, which is interesting because we have, and again, he has one hand raised aloft towards the heavens, just like Kevin McAllister, kind of reaching for divine inspiration from the angels in the O Holy Night sequence. And he is channeling, quite literally, that is the meaning of the card. The reason is his finger is pointed down, is he is channeling that angelic energy into the earth. Though he does it via his implements, the four implements on the table in front of him, of course, are a cup, a pentacle, a sword, and and the wand, obviously.
Isn't that also the hand placements of Baphomet?
Sure. Yes. No. It represents the idea of as above, so below, sure. Which is more is kind of universal in esotericism. It basically says that the upper, that is to say, the spiritual realm, reflects that which takes place on the material realm, or the interior realm, the realm of the soul, reflects that which takes place on the exterior. Mm-hmm. But what we see here in the magician card, Kevin is clearly the magician, in the sense that he is channeling the angelic energy from the church sequence directly into the earth so that he may bring about his works, defending. This is, as he says before the montage begins, this is my home and I must defend it. So, Cliff, we see here the cup, which is representative of Kevin pouring water all over the stairs to freeze the stairs, causing Joe Pesci to slip. We see the wand, representative of fire, the element of fire, representing the heating coil. Fire is literally coiled into a snake over the doorknob, the snake being another representation of the wand, which burns the M, got to figure out what that means, into his hand. Then we, of course, also have the sword, or the nail that he uses to pierce the foot of Daniel Stern. Now, what's interesting is that there's another tarot card that relates to injuries of the ankle or foot, which is the Five of Pentacles, because the Five of Pentacles shows two cripples outside of a church stained glass window in snow pouring down all around them. So, in a way, we could say that this card is qualified by the Five of Pentacles. Now, why would we qualify the magician with the Five of Pentacles? Because another divinatory lesson from the Five of Pentacles is the idea that one should not draw attention to one's own weaknesses, that one, merely like the two crippled people in the snow outside of the stained glass church in the Five of Pentacles, need only accept the love of their family, of God, of the church, etc., and go into the church, but they reject it. And what do we see at the beginning? Kevin McAllister is the Five of Pentacles, because why? He says, I've never packed a suitcase before. I don't know how to do that. He's a thorn in everyone's side because he's drawing attention to his weaknesses, and he is remaining out in the snowy cold, rejecting all of that angelic light that he will find on the other side of the stained glass by saying, he rejects his family by saying, I wish my family would just go away. So what do we have here? We have Kevin as the magician that emerges from the Five of Pentacles into his full magician state using his various implements. Is there anyone we haven't? Oh, yes, we have finally the pentacle, which is a star, which has a star on it. And what does he do to Daniel Stern's feet as he enters through the window? He places many star implements underneath them, which pierce his feet again, thus reinforcing the Five of Pentacles association. So again, the film, as you can see, that this is a yellow card. So like all the yellow cards, it kind of represents him in sort of full spiritual realization. He is wreathed on all sides by vines, thus showing he has kind of reconnected. The vine imagery, obviously a lot of stuff comes from the Bible, talking about reconnecting to the vine, reconnecting to the idea of God and all of that other stuff. So Kevin transitions from, and if you look, you can look it up right now. I'll put up the image. Boop. I'm not really going to put up the image. I'm sorry if I forget to do this later, everyone, of the Five of Pentacles, to put it by the magician. It looks just like Home Alone. Stained glass window, snow, all of that other stuff, and two people with bandages around their feet, just like Daniel Stern after the nail and the stars. So what can we learn from this? What can we take into our own Christmas season? We can say that this is a period of unique spiritual or angelic potency. So if you were ever going to try and channel a tremendous amount of energy, divine energy, into your own works, into some transmutational power in your life, take advantage of the energy of the Christmas season. Take advantage of the energies of your family. Take advantage of the energies of your community. Don't keep yourself out in the cold by remaining an isolated and cold individual. And aha, Cliff! Who else is in snow? The Hermit. I didn't think about it before, but the Hermit, who, just like the old man, is also standing with his hood on, holding his lantern against all of the snow. Don't be out in the snow. Come on inside. Come back close to the furnace, the fire, the hearth, etc. You guys get it. You know what I'm talking about. Be a magician, y'all. Just like Kevin McAllister. Channel the angelic energy. Change your life and become something cool. It's if like Bill Murray at the end of Scrooge. If not now, when? It's the Christmas season. Change now for the better. You can. You can do it. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah. All right, guys. So now there's really only one thing left to be done, Cliff, which is to determine who was the most jacked person in Home Alone. At the Full Metal Jacked Award, the award given every episode by Cliff to the character who is the most jacked, who has the best physique, the biggest muscles, etc. Sorry, I'm trying to mess with the levels. There you go. Or the biggest head, or the tightest black t-shirt like Ray Liotta. We'll figure it out. Anyway.
In Ray Liotta's t-shirt, we trust.
In Ray Liotta's t-shirt, we trust, exactly.
I think it's very clear who this award goes to in this winter movie where everyone's wearing coats and we don't really see much of anybody.
Bless you.
Bless you, bless you.
Thank you.
But the obvious winner is Joe Pesci. This is Joe Pesci at the peak of his physical fitness and the peak of his head size, engaging in a great many antics, kicking down a door, falling downstairs. He didn't do all his stunts, but he did some rough and tumble stuff in that household.
Bless you again.
Bless you. And after this, and he was still in his physically robust phase, My Cousin Vinny was to follow just a year later, where he plausibly knocks out that guy who's like a foot taller than him.
Yep.
And Casino, where he
kicks the shit out of more people.
Kicks the shit out of so many people with a pen and all other devices. Mm-hmm. So it'll have to be the certainly the most intimidating and scary person in the movie. Joe Pesci.
That's right. I like it. I like it. I like it. All right. So now the award has been given out to Joe Pesci. We've done our tarot draw. Quick, let's wrap things up before Taylor starts sneezing again. She can feel another one coming. So, again, had a fantastic experience. Really unified with really you guys.
Magical, yeah.
Really magical experience at the Paramount Theater seeing Home Alone. So until next time, I suppose, we will see all of y'all in a crowded theater.
Once later, y'all. There was a